Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. Talking about the Himalaya as the author of the new book, John Kay, legendary British historian, journalist and lecturer, calls them, and he should know because he's just written a book about the Himalaya, about exploring the roof of the world, about the history of the mountains, the people, the beliefs, and attempts by outsiders to conquer and exploit them. Now, Himalaya means abode, the realm of snow. So perhaps I should change the name of this podcast to Himalaya, the towering abode of snow that dwarfs all who approach. Anyway, that's my hubristic flight of fancy. I'll just get on with the podcast now. The Himalaya is such an extraordinary, such an exceptional part of the world. Nearly all the highest mountain peaks on Earth, 50,000 glaciers. One third of all of us human beings, depend on the Himalayas for fresh water. It's almost as big as Europe, and yet the population is scattered so thinly throughout the area. The geology is unstable as tectonic plates shift and clash beneath those mountains, driving them ever higher. And usefully, what a great metaphor, the borders, the political aspirations of neighbouring countries grind unevenly against each other in that region too. It's a part of the world that matters, folks. I hope you enjoy this podcast with John Kay.
T-minus 10.
Atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima.
God save the king.
No black-white unity till there is first some black unity.
Never to go to war with one another again.
And
liftoff.
And the shuttle has cleared the tower.
John, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for asking it.
Tell me about the geography of the Himalaya. What are we talking? How big, how wide, how inaccessible, how high?
The region I'm calling Himalaya, basically, if you look at a map of Asia, it's a great purple and white splodge in the middle. It's ground over an average height of 10,000 feet, and it's vast. East to west, it's about 2,500 kilometers. North to south, about 500 kilometers. So there's this great purple white splodge on a physical map of Asia, in the middle of the continent, which is Himalaya. And it includes five or six of the world's highest mountain ranges and, of course, the great Tibetan plateau, the Chungtuk. It's like an empty quarter of Tibet, except that it's actually empty three quarters. So it's a vast area. And the main mountain chains are kind of swagged around this Tibetan plateau, around the base of it, in a sort of long arc. And they include, first of all, the Great Himalaya, highest mountain range in the world, then the Karakorans, even higher in places, exactly the most glaciated non-polar region in the world, and then the Hindu Kush, which, of course, is the mountain range in Afghanistan and northern Pakistan, and the Kunlun, and so on. So there's all these various mountain ranges come together and form a sort of swag round the base of the Tibetan plateau.
And does this very distinct geographical region, has it got a religious and political distinctiveness, or has it always been fragmented, divided up into peoples living in valleys or external empires nibbling bits off the edge?
Yes, you're quite right. That certainly happened. But I mean, in physical terms, it is a unique ecozone. It's the only high-altitude ecozone in the world, the only ecozone we have, which is entirely over 10,000 feet. But this vast area has, of course, been nibbled away, as you rightly say, by all its neighbours from time to time. Diffusion of Buddhism from India spread into what we're calling Himalaya. Then Islam spread into the western extremities of Himalaya and virtually ground to a standstill in the mountains. Mongols and Manchus invaded from the north and the east. And, of course, nowadays the Chinese are busy grabbing what they prefer not to call Tibet. So it has been subject to encroachment from all sides throughout history. And this is not only in political and military terms, but also, as you rightly suggest, in cultural terms. So that Tibet, for instance, became the last great kind of repository of Buddhist scholarship, Indian Buddhism scholarship, long after Buddhism had been extinguished in India itself. In this vast area, the main regions of settlement of population are usually on the fringes, and it's there that you have the greatest variety of, particularly in places like Nepal and Kashmir, the greatest concentration of religious shrines, of temples, of cultural artifacts, and so on, whereas the great Changchun, the great center of Tibet, is largely empty and has very limited population. So for a place that's really pretty hostile in terms of a way of living, it has had an extraordinary number of invaders or would-be invaders over the centuries. This has led to its fragmentation. If you look at the map, all the little states strung along the south of the Tibetan Plateau, Bhutan, Sikkim, Nepal, Kashmir and Ladakh, and so on, Baltistan, Chitral. And these are the real centers of activity, of cultural life, of political life and so on, rather than in the center of the region, which, as I said, is largely uninhabited.
And those states and principalities and provinces that you've mentioned, have they been traditionally hard to unify because of the geography? And therefore, has there ever been a kind of Himalayan empire or polity?
The classic example, I suppose, is a 7th century Tibetan empire, when Tibet, rather amazingly, had its own empire in Central Asia, which spread not only from what we now think of as Tibet, but also through to places like Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, and also into Western China. And this was quite a formidable empire, founded by two of Tibet's earliest kings, but it didn't last very long, about 200 years. So in the 7th and 8th centuries AD, or CE. And then the only sort of comparable construct that I can think of is the Gurkha kingdom, which in Nepal and in the 18th century, which again spread from Nepal, from the Gurkha kingdom, up into Tibet, and also along the Himalayan chain right through to what's now Himachal Pradesh in India. And this was quite a formidable political and military unit, but again, quite short-lived, because there was a famous Anglo-Nepalese War in 1814-16, when the British invaded Nepal and virtually extinguished its militaristic tendencies. So these two short periods, the Tibetan Empire and the Gurkha encroachments, are the only examples I can think of a Himalayan-based empire or political construct of any size consequence.
And what about religion? You've mentioned some of the religions that have permeated the area, but it seems that there are parts of that world in which the same religions claim or assign divine importance to certain features. And you've got Hindus, Buddhists, Jains. Everyone seems to be drawn to the same places and mountains.
Yes, the original, or what's thought to be the original religion in most of Tibet was something called Pon, which is a precursor of Buddhism and was an indigenous belief system which accorded great importance to physical features like the mountains, for instance. The mountains were nearly all personified or deified as individual deities, and deities could, like all deities, they could fight with one another, they could make love to one another, they could collaborate and they could argue. So the mountains became a very important, not just a feature of the landscape, but a feature of the cultural landscape, the feature of the way of thinking in the region. And pilgrimage is one of the most distinctive features of the whole of Mali. And this isn't just Buddhist or Tibetan Buddhist pilgrimage to mountains, where the Hindu pilgrimages in Kashmir to Amarnath, and there is even some small Islamic pilgrimage activities in what's now northern Pakistan. So the landscape is very much a part of the belief system of all the peoples of Himalaya, and is just as pilgrimages, it's a characteristic feature of the region for as long as we know anything about it.
You listen to Dan Snow's History. We're talking about the Himalayas, or the Himalaya, all coming up.
We try to bring you cold, hard facts on Gone Medieval, but January is all about mysteries. Impossible riddles from medieval history that defy efforts to solve them. How did the presence of a mysterious saviour from the East turn into devastation? What secrets does a book written in an unknown code hide? Did kings and princes really die when history has assumed they did? I'm Matt Lewis, and in January, we'll see how close we can get to answering the unanswerable and ask how these mysteries might be solved in the future.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I'm looking for answers to the big questions about every aspect of life in the early modern period. Like, how did the memory of Anne Boleyn continue to influence the court of her daughter, Elizabeth I? How were fairies brought to life on the Elizabethan stage? And how did the arrival of male-only doctors threaten the lives of women? In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Subscribe now and follow me on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when you're using messaging apps, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high-quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes, and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage. Add unlimited photos and videos and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's auraframes.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Speaking of pilgrimage, tell me about some of the remarkable outsiders that you chart in your book that have become fascinated and bewitched by the Himalaya and have help to open the area up to study and conquest and development by the outside world.
Yes, the most interesting explorers, I think, were some of these sportsmen. They were basically interested in shooting specimens of the outlandish animal forms that one finds, the great wild yak, the great Marco Polo sheep, the world's largest sheep. The wild yak is the world's largest bovine creature. So sports were a great attraction, particularly for British travellers in the region. But a lot of these sportsmen explorers were also quite receptive to local culture and quite interested in it. And some of the most entertaining accounts of early travel in Tibet and Himalaya as a whole are from people who'd served on the infamous Young Husband expedition of 1904 when British Indian troops invaded Tibet, and when really the modern period of Tibetan history begins. So a lot of these people came as conquerors or part of this military expedition, and then reappointed to assignments for one sort or another in Himalaya and became quite knowledgeable on particular areas. There's a famous man called Bailey. He was always known to his friends as Hatta, H-A-T-T-E-R, Hatta Bailey. And I can only assume that's because they thought he was as mad as a hatter. He certainly was a most extraordinary man, and he was a crack shot and tremendous wildlife collector and a great explorer. And one of his assignments was to draw up what became known as the McMahon Line between northeast India and Chinese territory in eastern Himalaya. This involved working out where the natural frontier was in terms of the ethnic divide, in terms of the mountains and so on, where the natural frontier would run. As part of that exercise, he was working with a surveyor in the remotest southeastern corner of Tibet, which is quite unlike the rest of Tibet. I mean, it's incredibly wet for a start, has very high rainfall, and there's cloud cover and a lot of snow, and it's very, very difficult terrain. And it's also where the great river of Tibet, the Tsangpo, cuts right through the Himalayas to emerge in northeast India in Assam as the Brahmaputra. And so this Hatta Bailey fellow, one of his great expeditions was to try and discover how this river found its way through the mountains. Was it in a succession of amazing waterfalls or cataracts, or did it actually burrow underneath the mountains? And the case for Tsangpo becoming the Brahmaputra was quickly solved, but how the river actually cut through the mountains was an issue of some geographical interest. And while he was there, he was taking this, what would become the Manlike frontier, further and further west from Chinese territory to Bhutan. And in the course of this, he lit on one particular peak, which happened to be one of the most sacred of all Tibet's pilgrimage sites. And while he was in the sanctuary surrounding this peak, he saw a stag that he just couldn't resist. So he shot this stag, and his men were immediately horrified, and there's all sorts of terrible disasters that really have come to the expedition. And they insisted on he performing the pilgrimage, which is basically a circuit of the higher parts of the mountain, by way of penance for this terrible sacrilege that he'd committed. And so you end up with this sportsman actually performing an act of expiation in the form of a Tibetan pilgrimage to make up for his terrible crime of killing what turned out to be what's called a Sikkim stag. And it's actually probably the last known record of this particular animal, because it was extinct by the middle of the 20th century. Characters like this interest me. You know, he was a sportsman. He was interested in securing trophies and natural history specimens and so on, but he was also intrigued by the whole question of the relationship between the Himalayan peoples and their terrain and the mountains themselves, and how important these natural creatures, the mountains in particular, are to the local belief system.
I loved Alexandra David-Niel, if that's pronouncing her name right.
Yes, that's right. The pronouncing correct, Alexandra David-Niel. She was one of the most unlikely, but also extremely well-informed traveler, explorer. She was actually in French, so she's not called David Neal, as some people think, but David Neal. And she had been an opera singer. She performed at the Hanoi Opera. Those were days when Vietnam, Indochina was French, of course. At some point in her 20s, she had been attracted to Buddhism. And she went to live for a time in Sikkim in the northeast of India, and made one or two short excursions into neighboring bits of Tibet. And then her heart became set on getting to Lhasa. She saw Lhasa as offering sublime deliverance. She would be a pilgrim like all the other pilgrims, and she would join them and try and reach the forbidden city or forbidden capital of Tibet. And this she performed from China, actually, from Sichuan in western China. She joined a group of pilgrims who were visiting a peak on the border called Kawakapa, and she went round the peak. You do a peregrination around the mountain when you're paying your reverence. And she broke away with this young lama, who was her constant companion, and struck out for Lhasa. Now, that itinerary is incredibly confusing. She didn't really hold with place names and distances and bearings and so on. And so it's very difficult to trace her exact route, But she and her companion, this young Lao Yong, set off from the Chinese border in, I think it was about October, and they reached Lhasa in 1924 in time for the New Year celebrations, which happened usually in about February. So it was about a four-month march through the most appalling terrain. Of course, traveling just as Tibetan pilgrims, they had to beg their way effectively. And they got into Lhasa, were undetected by the British, had representatives there at the time looking out for people who had broken the British embargo on travel into Tibet. And they were actually discovered and were eventually sent packing down to Calcutta. Not only were they French, but they had no authorization whatsoever. You needed to have authorization either from the Tibetan government or from the British to get into Tibet in the 1920s. But as I say, her itinerary is a bit frustrating because you can't really tell exactly where she is. She mentions very few placemaps, but she comes up with all sorts of fascinating insights into Tibetan way of life. She was a great one for the mystical side of Tibetan Buddhism, and so she spent a lot of time observing unexpected rituals and seeing miracles and generally becoming quite an authority on Tibetan Buddhism. And this sustained her afterwards, because from India she went back to France and she became a tremendous celebrity and spent really the rest of her life writing books about Tibetan Buddhism and living on the income that they generated in Provence. She lived to 101. It died in 1960-something, I think. An amazing figure. She was also very, very small. She thought that was an advantage in Tibet because no one ever noticed her. Because she, unlike most Europeans, she wasn't taller than Tibetans. She was much smaller. Alexandra David Neil is still a revered figure in Buddhist circles, and her books are still published. And she was a great scholar. She wasn't particularly interested in the wildlife like Hatta Bailey. She wasn't interested in the politics either. She was just interested in obtaining this sublime deliverance that she thought she would achieve by reaching Lhasa. And she obtained a lot of Buddhist texts which weren't available in India, which was also quite achieved. So an amazing woman. I mean, there are one or two other female figures in the story, but she's by far and away the most outstanding and the most reputable.
What's happening strategically there today? It sits between three spheres of influence of three want-to-be great powers, India, China, and Russia and its former satellites, although I know that's an expression that could be changing day by day. We've seen border disputes in 2020s, 2021 between China and India. We've got instability now, it looks like, across the former Soviet republics of Central Asia. This is going to become a contested area.
Yes, it's still a very contested area. Actually, the real friction nowadays is really between the Indians and the Chinese. I mean, it's an incredibly long frontier. If you include Tibet in China, the China-India frontier, it's fast and, of course, through accordingly difficult terrain most of the way. And there are several kind of pressure points from an extreme northeast. The Indian state of what's called Arunachal Pradesh, the most northeasterly state in India, almost the whole state is claimed by China. They don't think that Arunachal Pradesh is part of India at all. And it's a bit the same at the other extremity of the mountains in the western Himalaya, in Ladakh, which is just the Indian bit of Tibet next to Kashmir, where again, Indian and Chinese forces have, in the last year anyway, have come to blows. And again, the frontier is disputed. So this is the main source of friction between India and China. But there are others. Well, first of all, India and Pakistan, who are disputing the large parts of what used to be northern Kashmir. The Pakistanis, at the moment, are building an enormous dam on the Indus River in what they call the Gilgit-Baltistan region. The Indians claim that this is actually part of the old Kashmir state, which they now claim as theirs in toto. And so Pakistanis had great difficulty raising the money for this, to build this colossal dam. And in fact, of course, the Chinese have come to their rescue and are happy to embarrass the Indians any way they can. And so the project is being funded largely by China as part of its China-Pakistan economic corridor, which itself is part of Mr. Xi Jinping's Belt and Road Initiative, which is very elastic construction. who seems to have involved just about anywhere the Chinese have strategic or economic interests. So the section between India and China, the tension between India and Pakistan, then there's all sorts of uncertainties, you say, is about, I mean, Russia was conceived by the British as being the main threat to the region, but that has subsided very much. And in, as you say, in the Russian satellites, places like Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and so on, are all now independent, and none of that poses a particular threat to the region because it's still very much subject to good relations with Russia or Russian influence. So that's not such a problem. But China, India, and Pakistan, India, are all disputing large chunks of Himalaya. That makes it very difficult to impose any kind of international supervision of what is, as I explained, this absolutely vital high-altitude ecosystem, the only one in the world.
John, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. What is the name of your book?
The book is called Himalaya, Exploring the Roof of the World. The Roof of the World was an Arabic term for the whole region. Nowadays, we normally call it Himalaya. And Himalaya is simply, Hima means, in Sanskrit, means snow, and Alaya means abode. So it means the abode of snow, the land of snow, the realm of snow.
Well, we're talking about the realm of snow on the right podcast here. That's what I like. Thank you very much, John Kay, for coming on the pod.
Thanks.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History Hit. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.